Good evening and welcome to NetLine Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga.
We should first understand that the frustration among students has gone beyond control. The only language of unheard concerns most of the time protest because you are demonstrating and you are trying to show your anger.
Malawi indefinitely closes one of its universities following violent student protests Friday night over a recent fee hike.
Bobo says his two wives, three children and elder brother have yet to be found a week after they were taken to the bush by armed men.
Government officials in Cameroon and the Central African Republic say abductions for ransom have spiked along their borders.
Well, first of all, it's an illegal pronouncement. It's not within the police power to suspend our meetings because these are not police meetings, they are our meetings, and they do not have the power to grant, deny, or suspend permission.
And in Uganda, the opposition National Unity Platform Party says it's illegal for the police to suspend its nationwide mobilization tour. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Libya's top prosecutor says he has opened an investigation into the collapse of two dams that caused a devastating flood in a coastal city. Teams were still searching for bodies in Derna on Saturday. It has been a week since the deluge killed more than 11,000 people. Heavy rains caused by Mediterranean storm Daniel caused deadly flooding across eastern Libya. The floods overwhelmed two dams, sending a wall of water several meters high through the center of Derna. Entire neighborhoods were destroyed and people were swept out to sea. The Libyan Red Crescent says more than 10,000 people are still missing. Searchers are digging through drifts of mud and hollowed out buildings, looking for bodies and possible survivors. The 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly takes place this week in New York. It's the main policy-making organ of the United Nations. Comprising all member states, it provides a unique forum for multilateral discussion of the full spectrum of international issues covered by the Charter of the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres will present his annual report on the state of the world. To find out what Africa hopes to achieve from this year's high-level session, I reached political analyst David Monda.
I think there's a lot in place for the continent in a whole range of different areas. Obviously, firstly, is the multilateral framework of the UN General Assembly. Africa has a majority of the members in the General Assembly, so that is a significant voting power. But if you think about policy, maybe I'll just highlight two main ones. Following up on the Africa Climate Change Summit, which was held in Nairobi, I think that's a very important space for African leaders to come and speak with one voice at the General Assembly in terms of climate change, in terms of technology transfer from developed to developing countries to enable Africa not only mitigate the effects of climate change, but also to grow its economy from the billions of dollars available in investment for green technology. But I think more broadly, it also gives the continent an alternate framework to have its voice heard specifically on some of the security and humanitarian crisis we have on the continent and find multilateral framework to address these challenges, whether it's floods, coup d'etats, or challenges around governance, democracy, and the rule of law on the continent.
Those are ideal issues to talk about at the General Assembly. But what do you say to those who say that from this assembly, nothing ever comes out, but maybe the UN Security Council has more power and to implement some of these policies?
This is a good critique of the United Nations more broadly, but also of the General Assembly and the Security Council in particular. We know the Security Council is not a democratic institution in regards to the reflection of its composition with the five permanent members that have veto power. They are reflective of a post-World War II global situation, which is just not relevant in 2023. But I think more broadly, to respond to the critics, there's very few alternatives to diplomacy, to speaking, and to these international fora. If countries are not speaking to each other, then what's the alternative to the United Nations? It would be conflict and war, and I think that would be even more complicated. So for those critics who speak to challenge the UN, I think the idea going forward is to try and figure out the best ways to reform the institution.
Do you think African nations would benefit more if they had a united voice at the UN General Assembly instead of articulating individual countries' concerns?
I think that's a very difficult thing to have one common position. You can have a broad theme or idea in terms of a continental vision, but it's really not realistic to expect 55 different countries to have similar interests. Right? African countries at very different developmental levels, whether it's in terms of their economies, their politics, their diplomatic weight, their influence in international affairs. But I think very similar to what we had with the Africa Climate Change Summit, I think these continental forums, where the different regions and leaders from the different regions, whether it's SADC in the south, East African Community in the East, ECOMOG in the West, and maybe the Gulf Cooperation Council for the North African countries. If these countries in the continent can actually come together in continental frameworks and try and identify broad areas of consensus in terms of the African continent, I think that would be very helpful. So, for example, around questions of economic justice, right, the ratings of some of the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the IMF, some of their lending policies have been very unfair to Africa. They unreasonably raise the risk level for the continent when borrowing, when African countries borrow. I think that's an area many countries or all countries on the continent can get behind. Also, the rating agencies like Moody's, some of their practices in terms of determining risk for lending to Africa and for the developing world more broadly is not always transparent and is very problematic, because if Moody's decides that, for example, Zimbabwe or Kenya or Rwanda is a high-risk country, that raises the interest rates that those countries will pay. It discourages investment, and in the long run, it penalizes these countries, which are already struggling with debt, to pay back loans or to get financing for critical public projects. I think those are areas that the continent can really look at and develop consensus. I think lastly, also another big one would be issues of climate change, because they disproportionately affect all 55 African countries a lot more than they affect some of the more industrialized countries that are really the cause of some of this climate change. The big economies in the US and in Europe that have created a lot of the challenges around climate change.
That's David Monda, a political analyst and professor of political science at the City University of New York. He spoke with me from New York. Malawi has indefinitely closed one of its universities following violent student protests Friday night over a recent fee increase. Students had given Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera 14 days to intervene. Police say 16 students were arrested and have been charged with disturbing the peace. Lameka Masina reports from Blantyre.
In a statement released Friday night, Yona Mungwira, registrar of the Nzuzu University, a University of Malawi campus in the country's north, suspended classes and ordered all students to leave campus indefinitely by 5 a.m. Saturday, saying the decision aims to preserve order and protect the university's property. Eyewitnesses say the students blocked the main road and besieged two ambulances that were rushing patients to a hospital, forcing Malawi police to fire tear gas to disperse the protesters. The University of Malawi in July announced a fee increment from about $350 to $600 per semester for undergraduate students and from about $780 to $920 per semester for graduate students. Students say the hikes were too high, however, giving President Lazarus Chakwera 14 days to intervene. Charles Dokera, leader of the Nede University students in Malawi, who issued the ultimatum, told VOA that Friday's protests were not only justified, but predictable.
In fact, the decision which the management has passed is a clear indication that the probably management itself does not have enough skills on how to control circumstances of that kind. It's something which may be a roundtable discussion or a commitment to take into account the concerns raised by students would have prevented everything.
Dokera faults university officials for closing the institution.
We should first understand that the frustration among students that have gone beyond control. There's only a language of unheard concerns most of the time, protest, because you are demonstrating and you are trying to show your anger. So the protest which we have witnessed yesterday is something which was foreseen.
Clifton Kawanga is the assistant registrar and public relations officer from Zuzu University. He told VOA the discussions about the concerns of the students over the fee hikes is underway.
The discussions were still ongoing before they went on the street. And even after that press release that the school fees was being raised, there have been discussions until yesterday when the students decided to go on the street.
Kondwani Nankuma, leader of opposition parties in Malawi's parliament, told lawmakers in July that some 2,000 students were on the verge of withdrawing from public universities on financial grounds. The fee hikes apply to all Malawi's public universities. Protests broke out at Nzuzu, however, because it was the first to begin its semester. In his address during the 25th Congregation and Silver Jubilee commemoration of Nzuzu University last week, though, President Chakwera said his administration will do what it takes to ensure that no student has dropped out of school of lack of adequate finances. After receiving the donation from a bank of about $93,000 for this year's presidential charity golf tournament, President Chakwera said the proceeds will, among others, be used to cover fees for needy students at public universities in Malawi. Lameki Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Government officials in Cameroon and the Central African Republic say abductions for ransom have spiked along their borders. The officials say armed gangs and rebels fleeing military crackdown in Central African Republic ask for as much as 50,000 to release their hostages. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaounde, Cameroon, on efforts to stop the almost daily abductions.
Officials in Cameroon's eastern border with the Central African Republic, or CAR, say civilians are increasingly falling victim to rebels attacking them for supplies or kidnapping them for ransom. The rebels and armed gangs loot markets and ranches and send villagers fleeing for safety. Abdullahi Bobo, a cattle rancher, says he is one of the victims in this latest wave of attacks. Bobo says his two wives, three children and elder brother have yet to be found a week after they were taken to the bush by armed men. He says the abductors called him on the phone demanding payment of about $10,000 to secure his family's freedom. Bobo spoke to VOA by messaging app on Thursday from Cameroon's eastern district of Ngawi, which borders Mount Gawi, the highest point in the Central African Republic. Bobo said his family may have been taken to the mountain or neighboring forests. Cameroon and CAR say attacks by rebels are reported on both sides of the border almost daily. Umaru Abo is mayor of Nyambaka, the capital of Cameroon's Nyambaka district. He says the rebels and armed gangs also attack localities in remote communities throughout the district. Abo says he has created militias in all the villages of his district to help government troops fight hostage takers. Abo says the militias are expected to report strange visitors and places where rebels and armed gangs hide from the military. Cameroon and CAR report that some armed rebels disguise themselves as people displaced by the ongoing armed conflict in CAR and attack people and communities for supplies and ransom. The UN peacekeeping mission to CAR, known as MINUSCA, which also has troops from Cameroon, this week said forces were deployed to border regions to fight the rebels and seize weapons the rebels abandoned when attacked by MINUSCA. Cameroon and CAR say armed gangs collect weapons abandoned by rebels and use them in either abducting civilians for ransom or stealing. Cameroonian Defense Minister Joseph Beti Asomu said President Paul Biya dispatched him to Mochebom, about halfway between the capital, Yaoundé, and the border with CAR, to mobilize troops for civilian protection. Kildadi Tageke Bukar is the governor of Cameroon's Adamawa region. He says rebel attacks on civilians have also been reported along Cameroon's northern border with Chad. He acknowledges that government troops were deployed to the Adamawa region immediately to protect civilians after Asomo's visit. Buka says military posts in all districts where rebels abduct for ransom in Cameroon have been equipped with enough troops, weapons, artillery, vehicles, and tracking devices. He says more government troops with special training to investigate, arrest, or eliminate armed gangs and rebels hiding in communities and in the bush have also been deployed to protect civilians on both sites of the porous and permeable border between Cameroon and the Central African Republic. In December, defense ministers from Cameroon and the CAR agreed to deploy a joint force along the border to protect civilians from hostage takers. The ministers said the joint force will also seize weapons that rebels hide in border towns and villages. Civilians say after the troops retreated in March, rebels relaunched abductions and increased the amount requested as ransom from $20,000 to $50,000. Abductees, whom rebels suspect of collaborating with government troops, are tortured and asked to pay larger sums, according to border villagers. Cameroonian military officials say the majority of abductees are merchants and cattle ranchers. CAR and Cameroon blame rebels and armed gangs fleeing military crackdowns for increased crime along their close to 900-kilometer border. Chad says armed groups on its territory also attack neighboring countries for food and money. Cameroon says it is intensifying collaboration with neighboring countries to safeguard civilians against abductions and harassment. Mokich Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
The cost of fuel in Kenya hit a record high on Friday after the energy regulator revised pump prices. The regulator's action came after the Kenyan government suspended the utilization of a fuel stabilization fund in its latest monthly fuel review cycle. According to local media, Kenyan members of parliament have expressed anger at the fuel price increase and demanded to be told why an oil deal President William Ruto's administration signed with three foreign companies has not benefited consumers. David Monda, again from the City University of New York, he tells me the move is both political and economic.
So I have two comments on that one. One is political, I think the other is economic. I think in terms of the politics, it really goes against Kenya Kwanza, which is the administration and government right now, President Ruto's government, to really look out for what they call the hustler, right, which would be the common Kenyan, the poorest of the poor in Kenya. Their election manifesto said they would fight to bring down the cost of living to improve their economic fortunes. When fuel stabilization, which is essentially a subsidy to the oil sector, is removed, it's going to raise the cost of living because fuel prices are a driver for the whole economy. So raising fuel prices raises prices across the board and creates major issues when you think about inflation. So I think politically, this is a big, big hit for the current government of President Ruto and his Kenya Kwanza coalition, because they are not living up to their manifesto, to their promises in last year's election. And remember, they are coming up to just about a year since they've been in government. The second element that really needs to be questioned here is the broader policy implications of the removal of this stabilization fund. These subsidies are considered by the World Bank, by the IMF, to be a distortion of the market, that they're inflationary, that there are distortion in terms of supply and demand and the real true cost of goods and services. They are not sustainable, very similar to what we had with the subsidy for fuel in Nigeria, which has also been scrapped. So in the Kenyan context, when we think about this fuel subsidy, it's really to think forward about the economic policy. If the government's going to remove fuel stabilization subsidies to support the economy, which essentially is to support the poorest of the poor, how will that impact the economy? It's going to create a lot more pressure on the poorest Kenyans. It's going to further raise the cost of living, inflation. And I think it's going to slow the economy going forward. In terms of policy planning, policymakers should really start to think about alternatives to fossil fuels, alternatives for the Kenyan economy, away from its over-reliance on imported fossil fuels. And not only thinking about the economy, it's just not long-term. It's not sustainable to have these economic shocks from fuel hikes in this way. But also in terms of the Africa Climate Summit, which we've had recently in the Nairobi Declaration, in terms of a long-term view, Kenya has a lot of capacity for green technology, whether it's solar, whether it's electricity, whether it's biomass. There's many alternatives to oil. And I think these really need to be explored, expanded, and scaled in a way that they'll be economically viable, and ultimately they'll bring down the cost of fuel because less fuel will be used as Kenya uses more green technologies.
Meanwhile, in the short term, obviously the rise in the cost of fuel has the overall effect of increasing transport costs, worsening inflationary pressures, increasing the cost of doing business, and generally slowing down the rate of economic activities in the country. Did the government consider the plight of the ordinary Kenyan?
I think they should, and I think this is where multilateral negotiations would be important. I think maybe they can seek to work with international financing organizations like the IMF, the World Bank, to see if they can get some kind of credit for the economy, some kind of grants, economic support with international partners to Kenya. But I think also the government should also look internally to try and reduce its expenditure. The fraud and waste within the Kenya government is incredible. It's very big. So I think reducing the size of government, the levels of fraud and waste, I think will also be very important. In the long term, when we're thinking about these broader economic questions, really identifying policy frameworks that will mitigate the cost of living and support some of the poorest people in Kenya, because this is just not sustainable to have this kind of price hike. It's a disincentive to business because any additional cost in fuel will just be passed on to the consumer. And I think it's not a good sign for the Kenyan economy. Lastly, I think Kenyans should start thinking about a strategic oil fund like they have in, for example, in the United States, to take care of these kind of situations when the country is facing a deficit in terms of oil. But I think long term, it's really a broader question about proper fiscal and economic planning going forward. And I think that's an area the Kenya Kwanza administration needs to improve on.
That's David Monda, a political analyst and professor of political science at the City University of New York. He spoke with me from New York. In Uganda, the opposition party National Unity Platform, or NUP, says it's illegal for the police to suspend its nationwide mobilization tour. The party recently launched activities across the country, including meeting supporters, holding rallies, and opening offices in preparation for the next general election. But the police announced they were suspending opposition events after accusing the NUP and its leader, Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, of inciting violence, defaming President Yoweri Museveni, and promoting sectarianism, as well as intimidating and harassing citizens. Attorney Medad Segona is a member of parliament and a leading member of the NUP. He tells VOA's Peter Cloche the police do not have the legal mandate to stop or indefinitely suspend activities of the party.
Well, first of all, it's an illegal pronouncement. It's not within the police power to suspend our meetings because these are not police meetings, they are our meetings, and they do not have the power to grant, deny or suspend permission. We have never sought permission from them, which is what I saw in their letter to us and subsequently in their communication to the public in their press release that they granted us permission. We have never sought permission from them because it's not within the law. The court has repeatedly pointed out to them that it's not within their power. Secondly, we have never and never appeared their unlawful terms of saying, one, we shall not hold processions, you shall hold your meetings in town halls. Why must we hold meetings in town halls, first of all? It's a humongous cost on us to hire a town hall. Secondly, we have many supporters to address. They cannot fit in any town hall.
They said you had an agreement, and the agreement is to abide by the guidelines, but the NUP violated the agreement on so many occasions.
We've never had that agreement. Our agreement has been and can only be with the law. They have never even told us those things they are talking about now. They simply purported to permit, and we never sought permission. But we said, fine, we can ignore the language. It's a language based on ignorance of the law or simply contempt of the law. So we have never had such agreement.
But, Medad, the police are saying that the mobilization activities which they suspended were being used to incite violence, promote sectarianism, and make a legitimate cause for removal of an elected government and issuance of defamatory statement against President Yoweri Museveni. How do you respond to that?
First of all, it's absolutely false. We have not incited or advised anybody to remove Yoweri Museveni except in accordance with the Constitution of the Republic of Uganda. And Honorable Kyagulanyi has been consistent and persistent on this call. He says, we shall remove him in accordance with the Constitution. Secondly, we have not incited anyone to attack any other person.
The police are also saying that in all areas where NUP mobilization activities have been carried out, there has been total breaches of the guidelines that's causing public disorder, loss of business, unnecessary jam and vandalization, loss of lives where Norma Mugisha died and 10 others were injured in an NUP convoy.
Now, first of all, even for a road traffic accident, you must blame somebody and you make it appear so overtly criminal. I'm surprised. In Genome 7's convoys, I don't know how many people have died, even when he's not being pursued by anyone. But Mugisha's death is regrettable. He was our member. It was an accident and totally an accident. Secondly, the vandalization. I'm even suspicious now that the police or the state could be deploying some people to cause chaos. But that's the very purpose of the law. And that's why that's the very purpose of the information. We relay to the police, we inform them of our meeting so that they can provide security to people and against those that may intend to cause a breach of peace. So what the police is saying is an abdication of duty and responsibility on their part, because it is their responsibility to keep law and order, protect people and their property. There is no breach of peace. Where can they cite a breach of peace? Even when our people found somebody holding a pistol and close to our president, he was not beaten. He was not assaulted. They simply pointed out to the police and said, please take this one out of here so that he does not cause a breach of peace and law. So those are excuses
I think Genome 7 does not want his opponents to organize, and he can only find reason to disrupt peaceful gathering. From Kabale to Arua, we've not had the incident of breach of peace.
Now that you said what the police have done by suspending the nationwide mobilization tour of the NUP, what are you going to do about it?
Our duty is to inform them. We shall inform them, receive a response from them, and we shall determine our next course of action.
That's Medad Segonam, the Ugandan Member of Parliament and the leading member of the NUP. He spoke with VOA's Peter Klote from Kampala. In Ghana, a prominent parliamentarian from the main opposition party, National Democratic Congress, or NDC, is planning to retire from parliament in 2025. Attorney Cletus Avokam, who is a six-term lawmaker, represents the Bila in the country's Upper West region. He has served in several roles, including majority leader in parliament and as Minister of Lands and Forestry, as well as Minister for Interior. Supporters say Avoka has demonstrated a commitment toward entrenching the tenets of democracy in Ghana with his well-articulated contribution to debates and measures being considered in parliament. To learn more about his decision to step down and what the future holds for him, VOA's Peter Klote reached Cletus Avoka.
You know, all things being equal, there is a beginning and there is an end. And then it is important that whatever we do, you look at the timing and the circumstances. I have contested all the 8 elections in the Fourth Republic since 1992. I contested 1992-96. I'm one of the oldest MPs in Parliament. Out of the 8 elections, I lost 2 and then won 6. So I'm one of the long-serving MPs in Parliament House today.
Do you think the time has now come for you to retire? Because some people are saying your experience is required to at least groom the up-and-coming lawmakers. What do you think?
It's appropriate to say that. But, you know, the environments differ from what is happening in the U.S. and then what is happening in a third world country like Ghana. In 1992 and 96, those who were campaigning for me or assisting me have now grown up. And then they are eyeing to be also recognized. So I have achieved what is reasonable in life, in the sense that I have been in Parliament 6 times. This is my 24th year. If I don't contest next year, 24 years in Parliament. I have been a minister for about 4 ministries. I have been the majority leader of the Parliament of Ghana between 2010 and 2013. So I think that it is appropriate now for me to step aside and let a younger fellow take over.
Have you identified somebody you would want to pass the torch to?
Yes, I have done so, but advisedly. These days, it is a democratic dispensation. So you cannot say that I want this man to go. The fellow will have to subject himself to primaries, to elect at the local level, at the constituency level, and then, of course, at the national level. So what I have tried to do is to build a legacy behind for the young people who are behind me to emulate. For example, I built a legacy of integrity. I'm not boasting, but I have been regional minister, a minister for lands and forestry before, minister for environment, science and technology, interior minister, and the majority leader. All these since 1992, you've not heard my name in public as being corrupt or abusing my office or doing anything untoward. I have established an unblemished record. So I've been winning because of my humility. Humility is very important, transparency, and then honesty. And then I serve everybody. So if you are able to imbibe these values, then succeeding me will be very easy. And I've tried to inculcate this to those who are behind me. So I wouldn't say that I have somebody, I have groomed one individual, and then pick him and say support him. No, it would be wrong for me to do that because it was not only one fellow who supported me. And I tried to build a team and not to build one person. Mm. So I'm confident that with this legacy, anybody who takes over from me will try to follow up.
So what is next for you after you hang your proverbial boots in Parliament?
What I want to do is to work hard so that the National Democratic Congress, NDC, under our flag bearer, John Mahama, his ex John Dramani Mahama, will win the 2024 elections. We want a paradigm shift from what has happened in Ghana for the past 7 years, where there's now a culture of silence in all the departments, agencies, and in the country. We want John Mahama to take over and then see how we can minimize the incidence of hardship and suffering that we are going through in Ghana today. So I'm going to focus my attention first in making sure that, or in trying to assist the NDC to win the elections in 2024, both parliamentary and presidential. After that, if your mom is in office, I will use my experience and knowledge to serve the party and the government in power so that we can build a stable democracy in this country. I'm doing this against the background of good health and strength.
What do you think are the chances of the NDC winning back power in 2024?
Oh, very, very bright. The NDC's chances are very, very bright. We will not be complacent. We are not complacent, and we should not be complacent at all, because the poverty is very pervasive, the suffering is very pervasive. And then, you know, in Africa and in some other places, these days, it's money that talks. Money, monocracy, no more democracy. So even though we have the goodwill, and then we think that we can win the elections hands down, we are not taking anything to chance, because the current government, the incumbent government, has a lot of resources, and then they can do a lot of things that are not in tune with modern democracy. So we are going to be vigilant in the elections. We'll work hard, we'll campaign hard, we'll be very vigilant on election day, at the police station, and then we'll be very vigilant at the collation center. And I'm confident that at the close of the day, His Excellency John Dramani Mahama will clinch victory, and then we'll also win the parliamentary majority.
That's Attorney Gleta Savoka, who is a six-term lawmaker in Ghana. He spoke with my colleague Peter Klote. One of the world's most popular apps, TikTok, is under growing scrutiny in Kenya over what critics see as explicit content, hate speech, and offensive behavior. An activist has petitioned Parliament to ban the Chinese app, even as millions of young Kenyans use it for entertainment, social connections, or even to make money. Francis Ontamwa reports from Nairobi.
Then you end up with something that is so messy.
Anna Montez is a minor TikTok sensation. She shares live tutorials on makeup artistry at least 3 times a week. Not long ago, she had a conventional job, but quit to concentrate on her passion. Today, Montez says she's making more money than her job ever offered.
I've seen myself get followers. I've seen myself grow up to 20,000 new followers in like 2 weeks. And with that comes customers, comes interactions, comes brand collaborations, a lot of things. So that has been a new experience, interesting, and I'm loving this space.
Montez is just one of millions of Kenyans who use TikTok and one of a growing group leveraging the social media platform to try to make a living. But Montez's prospects could be threatened if an activist has his way. Bob Ndolo, an IT specialist and a father of two, once TikTok shut down in Kenya, recently submitted a petition to Parliament asking lawmakers to consider a ban on the app.
With TikTok, you go to a live coverage and you'll find those young girls that you can call your sister, your auntie, your mother. They are all there, yeah, half naked. And what they are doing, they are selling their bodies.
According to a 2023 survey by Reuters Institute Digital News report, Kenya is a global powerhouse in the use of TikTok. 54% of Kenyans utilize the platform for various reasons. The Kenyan government says TikTok and other social media apps contribute $3 million every month to Kenya's economy. Recently, President William Ruto held a virtual meeting with TikTok CEO, who agreed to implement some restrictions on the app and establish an official presence in Kenya. Globally, numerous countries have imposed partial or total bans on the Chinese-owned application on privacy and security grounds. In Africa, Senegal and Somalia have banned TikTok, and at least 3 other nations are considering similar measures. Bright Gameli is a cybersecurity researcher.
Governments are supposed to be able to come up with regulatory processes and policies that can govern the way such foreign applications are being used in the country. Right now, if those measures are not put in place, how are we going to make sure that we are protecting ourselves and our kids?
Montez says anti-TikTok activists are not being realistic about the modern world.
And I do understand why it's a concern. But the truth is that these things have happened in real life. They have not started now. So as things change, as technology improves, these things will still penetrate into these spaces. That does not mean that you ban the space entirely. Yeah? We don't all have to suffer.
Parliament has yet to begin formal debate on the proposed ban. In the meantime, Kenyans find themselves torn between preserving digital rights for its creative youth and keeping the online environment safe for its population. Francis Ontomwa for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Douglas Simpoga, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Samson O'Malley, and that will be followed by music from our African collection. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go to Abuja and join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Africa Women's Youth Handball Championship got underway in Tunisia on Saturday. The Tunisian under-18 handball team drew with their Guinean counterpart 18-18 in a Group A Day 1 game played on Saturday evening in Monastery. Algeria lost 18-28 points to Nigeria in their first Group A match. In Group B, Egypt won their match against DR Congo by 4-10-0, while Angola defeated Morocco 37-15 points. Under the competition's format, the eight teams will qualify for the tournament's quarterfinals on Tuesday. The top four teams in the final standings will qualify for the 2024 Women's Youth World Championship. In badminton, Egypt is set to serve as the first host of the 2024 Para Badminton World Circuit as it is scheduled to stage the opening event of the year. The Para Badminton International in Cairo is due to take place from January 22nd to 28th. 2024 and is preceding the main event on the calendar. The World Championships are scheduled to be held in the Thai city of Pattaya from February 20th to the 25th. It will be the first chance for athletes to earn world ranking points which count towards qualification for the Paris 2024 Paralympic Games. In mixed martial art news, UFC middleweight contender, South African professional mixed martial artist Dricus du Plessis believes former champion Nigerian-born Israel Adesanya churned out one of his worst performances when he lost his title to Sean Strickland at the UFC 293 last Saturday. Du Plessis was supposed to fight Adesanya, but an injury led to Strickland stepping in and defeating Adesanya for the middleweight title. Du Plessis thinks Adesanya looked off from the start and didn't fight his best.
Now, Adesanya was missing every shot. His timing was off, his speed was off. But, you know, Strickland did what he had to do to win that fight. And in my honest opinion, you know, like I said, congratulations on Strickland. He did what he needed to do to win that fight, and he did it great. But it wasn't something special that he did. He fought the exact same fight he always fights. He fought the exact same way he always fights.
In athletics, Ghana is considering increasing the number of the country's athletes to the 2024 Paris Olympic Games. At the Tokyo Olympics, the West African nation was represented by only 14 athletes across five disciplines, with Sam Tai's bronze medal in boxing being the sole medal won. Ghana's chief de mission for the Paris 2024 Games, Isaac Dua, is optimistic about increasing the country's representation in the upcoming global tournament in Paris.
We are less than a year ago, and their plans are far advanced to make your team Ghana qualifies. For history, our strength has always been boxing, athletics, and those are the few swimmers who qualify to the universality, and also judo and weightlifting.
And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports.
Thanks, Samson. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in the time of conflict and in time of peace. Here is one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There is broad consensus that the decision to include the African Union as the 24th member of the 20 group is highly significant. Previous efforts to give the African continent such a status have been unsuccessful. But as Africans everywhere embrace this welcomed status, they should bear in mind what was the sentiment in the Group of 20 in this year's summit. It was made clear that the group is not the real instrument or body to tackle growing or pressing international issues or geopolitical issues, but essentially an economic one. Although they could take into mind the impact of geopolitical difficulties on their activities, This being the case, the African Union may have to take further steps to enhance its status at the international table when are pressing geopolitical issues as well. When the OAU was transformed in South Africa after the end of apartheid and the end of white minority rule, it was the belief that the time was ripe to adopt the name Union. Of course, Union means more. And if you look at the way the European Union has gone, you could see they moved from the coal and steel community, then they moved to the European Economic Community, and then to the European Union. During those periods, there were many strong institution building to go with it. So the African Union will have to see what institutional developments it will have to undertake. Of course, the African continent has moved from the loose groups, the Moroccan group, the Liberian group, and then at the wake of the 1960-64 Congo crisis, they moved to creating the Organization of African Unity. So the task ahead will be difficult because to go through these stages will require African states to take difficult decisions. If you look at the European Union, they have today a president of the European Union. They have a parliament of the European Union. They have a central bank of the European Union. They have a court of the European Union. And this gives them the advantage of making important decisions at the international table. They also have their own currency, the euro. And it's not difficult, it's not easy to become a member of the European currency. So these things have to be taken in mind as the African moves along. Many African states have been hesitant to move further. But if Africa is to maintain its status at the international table with muscle to make difficult decisions, then it has to be engaged in institution building. Right now, it is very loose. When the Assembly of Heads of State and Government meets, they decide on who should be the current chairman in between the summits. You have the secretariat of the African Union who is given the authority to run the secretariat. All this will have to change if Africa will have a strong voice. So as we all applaud what was achieved in New Delhi under the leadership of Premier Modi, we should also know that Africa has a lot more to do to strengthen the status of the African Union at the international table. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
This love that make me shaman, yeah. I'm a little baby, marama. Even when my brain just did tanana. Only you, baby, lying in my corner.
And now it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
This girl, now God will give them to me. I'm in love.
Sports. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. From the Nightline Africa team, we thank you for joining us.